Welcome to the Science Podcast for November 30th, 2012. I'm Carrie Klein.
And I'm Edward Hermy. This week, how crocodiles get their scales, Myanmar's universities get a boost, and the latest from Messenger.
Does the planet closest to the sun have water ice at its poles? This question was driven by discoveries 20 years ago, and now, finally, we're prepared to answer that question.
Plus, a few stories from our online daily news site.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
Skin, hair, fur, and scales are all elaborations on a theme. Keratin-based structures that act to protect the body, regulate moisture, and serve to camouflage or attract attention. And it has long been thought that these structures follow similar developmental pathways, despite being present in diverse amniotes like mammals, birds, and reptiles. Science's Sarah Crespi spoke with Michelle Milinkovic about a very different developmental path for scales on the face and jaws of crocodiles.
Various lineages of amniotes display keratinized skin appendages, for example, feathers or hairs or scales, and these differentiate in the embryo from genetically controlled units. We show that contrary to skin appendages in other amniotes, face and jaw scales of crocodiles emerge from a physical, self-organizing stochastic process, cracking of the developing skin in a stress field.
So, as you say, many amniotes have keratinized appendages. What's the typical path for, say, the development of a scale or a feather?
So first, it is still an open question whether mammalian hairs, bird feathers, and reptilian scales are homologous or if some of them evolve convergently. Mm-hmm. But anyway, in all cases, skin appendages are developmental units. What I mean is that each hair in mammals, each feather in birds, or each scale in reptiles differentiates and grows from a primordium that can be identified, for example, with probes targeting specific genes.
So there's a little something there that's going to develop into a feather or a scale.
Exactly. And even at the stage where the skin is morphologically completely homogeneous, when you use these probes, you can actually visualize a group of cells that define each primordium.
So what made you decide to look into how the scales on the face and jaws of crocodiles form?
Well, the reason why we looked into this is simply because reptiles, most of them actually, such as most snakes and lizards, they have large scales on the head for mechanical protection, okay? Mm-hmm. And these scales form a very predictable symmetrical pattern. It's very obvious when you look at a snake, for example. And actually, these head scales are even named according to their position of the head. You know, you have the nasal scales. Mm-hmm. And each scale on the right side of the head has a symmetrical counterpart on the left side of the head. And what is amazing is that when you look at the pattern of scales on the head of a crocodile, the shapes of the scale is irregular, and there is no symmetry of the scale pattern between the left and right side of the head. And that's simply this observation that prompted us to really investigate this issue much further.
So you were able to observe that there's something very different about the scales on the head and jaws of a crocodile.
Yeah.
But how were you able to show that it was a result of a different mechanism, not just perhaps a random scattering of the primordia?
Actually, the first part of the study was to make statistical analysis of the pattern, because the face and jaws of crocodiles are covered by these polygonal scales. And these polygons are irregular, their spatial distribution seems quite disorganized. Mm-hmm. So we needed to perform a mathematical analysis of this head scale pattern. The problem is that accurate analysis of geometric parameters, like angles or areas, requires work in three dimensions rather than two dimensions. So we needed to perform high-resolution 3D geometry and color texture reconstructions.
So you had to actually build crocodile heads in the computer.
Yeah, exactly. So for each animal, you acquire something like 120 high-resolution color pictures, mm-hmm. and then you feed these images into a sophisticated software pipeline for highly accurate 3D reconstructions.
So this is how you figured out that there was no symmetry between left and right sides of the head. But what about the mechanism for the creation of this pattern?
Okay. Our analysis of the scale patterns in crocodiles indicate also qualitative and statistical signatures of cracking, a phenomenon which is well known in physics but so far absent from biology. So if you take cracking, it's a process for a material layer that causes its fracture into adjacent polygonal domains. And there are familiar examples, like dried mud. And in all these cases, the material layer is shrinking and is adherent to a non-shrinking substrate, such that a stress field builds up and causes fractures to appear. The resulting pattern is random in the sense that the exact position of individual cracks cannot be predicted. But the resulting crack pattern is characterized by qualitative and statistical features that we also observed in the head scale pattern of crocodiles.
So you could tell from the patterns that it was formed by a cracking process.
Well, these are inferences on the basis of the scale pattern observed in the crocodiles long after this pattern has been generated. Okay.
Yeah.
So we, of course, also decided to use developmental biology techniques to further investigate this hypothesis. So we analyzed the development of crocodile embryos using probes for genes involved in the development of scale primordia. And that's where the result is quite spectacular, because what we observe is that all body scales in crocodiles follow that same principle of development that we discussed before. A spatial distribution of primordia is established, and then each primordium differentiates into a scale. So this is indeed a developmental unit. Okay. On the other hand, crocodile head scales, they do not form from scale primordia at all. Instead, what you observe is that grooves progressively appear on the face and jaws, propagate, and interconnect to form a continuous network across the developing skin.
So those are the cracks.
Yeah, these are the cracks. So actually, what is amazing is that the scales on the face and jaws of crocodiles are not serial homologs of scales elsewhere in the body. And they are not even genetically controlled developmental units, but they emerge from a process which is entirely analogous to physical cracking.
So where is the force coming from that's causing the surface to crack?
Yeah, indeed. If you take classical cracking process in physics, it's due to shrinkage of a material layer, which is adherent to a non-shrinking substrate, like for mud, for example, that is drying. But crocodiles have a particularly thick and rigid skin. And the skin covering a crocodile's head is even thicker and more keratinized. And we suggest that it's the rapid growth of the crocodile embryonic facial and jaw skeleton combined with the development of this very stiff skin that generates the mechanical stress that causes cracking. So remarkably, here it's not the cracking layer that shrinks, like in drying mud or cooling ceramics, but the underlying substrate layer that grows.
The bones of the face.
Exactly, the bones under the skin.
Interesting. So how can what you've learned about these patterns on the crocodile's head, how can that be used more broadly?
Okay, well, I think that there are two answers to your question. First of all, if you think about the great mathematician Alan Turing, he has theoretically demonstrated in the 50s that various stable patterns of morphological elements, for example, could be generated in living systems through diffusion and interactions among their molecular determinants. And this model turned out to be correct in many cases. But our study indicates that there is maybe a larger set of physical processes that contribute to the production of the diversity of patterns we do observe in living systems. So a second reason is that our analysis indicate that cell proliferation in the epidermis is vastly increased in the deep region of the skin grooves that correspond to cracks. So that would be something like, I don't know, a healing process, if you wish, that allows the skin layer to maintain its continuous covering. Of course, a fascinating perspective would be to understand this coupling of the local biological process of cell proliferation with this purely physical parameter of mechanical stress. So what we think is that physical parameters such as mechanical tension do play very important roles in the local modification of cell proliferation rates, which in turn, and that's the key point, in turn can cause the developing tissue to bend or bulge. And this is, of course, potentially relevant for all developmental stages of all animals. And, of course, the key will be to understand this interplay, right, between physically and genetically controlled parameters, and, of course, not only in the crocodile embryo, but in many, many other systems at different developmental stages.
Fascinating. Well, Michelle Milinkovic, thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Michelle Milinkovic and colleagues crack the code of crocodile skin in a Science Express report this week. You can find the article and an accompanying slideshow at www.scienceexpress.org.
The Southeast Asian country of Myanmar, formerly known as Burma, has been effectively cut off from the world since a military coup in 1962. Its once flourishing universities slowly withered as enrollment plummeted. However, in response to recent political changes, many countries have suspended their sanctions, and some universities are seeing their first crop of undergrads in a decade. Science's Richard Stone spoke with me about the history and future of Myanmar's universities.
After Burma won independence from the UK in the late 1940s, they inherited a great infrastructure and were able to build on that and develop one of the best university systems in Southeast Asia in the 1950s. It had powerful attractions for other countries. Johns Hopkins University set up a research center there in Rangoon in the 1950s. So it was really internationally recognized university system back then. Then you had the military coup d'etat that occurred in 1962. Since then, over the last half century, it was steady decline, a deterioration of the quality of the teaching standards for professors there to connect with researchers in foreign countries. And probably the most tragic aspect was the crackdown on student protesters. So there was a series of protests at the University of Rangoon in the 1960s and 1970s, and culminating in 1988 in massive countrywide protests, and a lot of students over these years died. What attracted me to the story was it's really a matter of a country trying to regain something it lost. Now, to contrast that with a lot of other countries in this region, which are just now trying to attempt to build higher education systems. So they're starting at a relatively low level and gradually getting better and better. But in the case of Myanmar, you have a country which had something wonderful, and then it was destroyed. And now it's going through a very painful process of trying to rebuild this once prestigious system.
So you actually traveled to Myanmar to visit some of these universities. Can you describe that experience?
This was actually my third trip there. I was in Myanmar in 2007 twice, and at that time I was reporting on some of the archaeological sites there. Now, at that time, 2007, military was in firm control, and it was impossible to meet with Burmese scientists, Burmese professors. It was really a repressive system, and people were scared, so they would not talk to a Western journalist. I had no possibility to set foot on a single university campus back then. So you contrast that with my trip earlier this month, where I was able to visit six universities. And there were a few times where I was the first American to ever set foot on that campus. For example, the University of Dagon. The university was established 20 years ago. I was the first American there. So it was really a special trip. And it's a sign of how Myanmar is really opening up now. It's really flourishing in the sense that people are able to have contact with foreigners much more freely. And after years of isolation, years of neglect, the universities there are able to really seek new international ties. The recent trip, Johns Hopkins President Ronald Daniels visited University of Yangon last January. And he was the first American there since the military took over in 1962. So you have this fantastic opening up period now, this reform, where the universities are trying to seize this and they're trying to really recover from the total destruction where higher education basically was dismantled.
So why are people hopeful now that Myanmar is capable of reinvigorating its higher education? What's happened in the politics of the country that has changed this perspective?
What you have is a president, Thein Sein. He is a former general. And what he has done in terms of reintroducing press freedoms, civil liberties, he's surprised people, both outside Myanmar and his own people, who are just surprised that this opening up has taken place so rapidly. So you have a really promising trend now. Now, it's true that a system that has been repressed for decades, it's going to take time to change. Change really can't happen overnight, especially when you're talking about the people's mindsets. There's still some residual fear of being candid. And that's certainly the case with one professor who I met. And when I was talking with her during my reporting trip, she was very open and she spoke freely about her childhood there. And then she came under pressure, and there's still some elements of the old regime which people fear there. Now, that said, the steps that President Thein Sein has taken to open up Myanmar and to make it more liberal, I think it is a very promising trend. And that's why universities there now feel that they have this opportunity to reach out and to try to fully rebuild, regain prestige. One of the landmarks on what is bound to be a very long journey is the reopening of the top two engineering universities to undergrads. Undergrads had not been allowed on the campus of Yangon Technological University and Mandalay Technological University since 2002. So the first time in a decade, they have undergrads. And that's seen as a very exciting, very optimistic step they're taking.
So what is the current state of universities within Myanmar? What is life like for the average student?
It's still a very unusual and dysfunctional system. You have Yangon University, which was in the 1950s the top university in the country, and there's no undergrads. So there's just roughly 5,000 graduate students there. So all the undergrads study at these satellite campuses. So you have this division where you don't have a fully functional campus life, which the universities in Europe and the USA, you would find there. You have a much different kind of campus life. And the universities themselves, they were deprived, they were neglected for decades. They had practically no resources. So many of the universities and teaching labs have hardly any equipment. Mm-hmm. One other very exciting aspect was President Obama's visit, and he gave a speech at the University of Yangon, and it was really uplifting in the sense that just a few years ago, this would be unimaginable, that a country that was spurned, it was basically a pariah state, just a couple short years ago, now has progressed so rapidly to the point where they had President Obama speaking at a university that had once been one of the most esteemed in Southeast Asia, that had basically seen its star fallen. And this is a really, for the university itself, a very uplifting moment. And I think that people are hoping to move quickly there. The professors I met, they realize that they're far behind. And they really want to move quickly to try to catch up now.
Obviously, this is going to be quite an uphill battle for all of these universities. What else is Myanmar really going to need over the next few years in order to reach their goals of reinvigorating their universities?
Well, one of the Western experts I interviewed there said basically all they have now are buildings. So they need everything. They need better curriculum. They need textbooks. They're especially eager to have foreign experts come and give lectures. They also have to make some structural changes to their primary and secondary school system. Right now, they currently offer 11 years from basically first grade through 11th grade. So this shortfall of 1 year compared to, say, European U.S. system, that basically means that men and women, when they enter university, they are not ready. The Yangon Technological University has identified this problem of students being very poorly prepared. And when they're reopening their undergraduate courses next month, they're going to institute a six-year Bachelor of Engineering degree. So as the former rector said, this is probably the longest bachelor degree out there. And it's because the students just are not ready. So they have to take a full year, kind of a fundamental course to acquire basic knowledge that the student should have acquired prior to university. It's really the whole education system needs some major fundamental changes to try to regain lost ground.
Mm-hmm. Well, Richard Stone, thanks for talking with me.
Thank you, Edward, for having me.
Richard Stone writes about Myanmar's efforts to make up lost ground in higher education in this week's issue.
For nearly 2 years, NASA's Messenger spacecraft has been in orbit around the planet Mercury, beaming back data and observations that have transformed our understanding of the closest planet to the Sun. After reporting initial findings, Sean Solomon spoke with Stuart Wills on the Science Podcast in September 2011. This week, with the publication of 3 new reports, Solomon updated me on Messenger's findings, including an answer to a decades-old question.
Does the planet closest to the Sun have water ice at its poles? This question was driven by discoveries from Earth-based radar 20 years ago that Mercury has polar deposits that have radar characteristics that are best matched by water ice. But there have been no other kinds of direct chemical measurements, no measurements from a spacecraft at Mercury until Messenger was placed into orbit. And now, finally, 20 years after the first discovery from Earth-based radar, we are prepared to answer that question in the affirmative.
Aha, so the answer is yes. So you made this determination by using a suite of tools, including a neutron spectrometer and a laser altimeter. How did these tools and the data that they transmitted together indicate to you, yes, there is water on Mercury?
It's been a wonderful story. The neutron spectrometer is very sensitive to hydrogen. Neutrons are generated when cosmic rays hit a planet. Hydrogen is the best absorber of neutrons, and so a neutron spectrometer looks for the signature of hydrogen near the surface by looking for decreases in the flux of neutrons coming from the planet. It's one of the most diagnostic signatures of hydrogen. That's not precisely water ice, but of course hydrogen is the main constituent of H2O. Mm-hmm. And so the neutron spectrometer on Messenger showed us that there is abundant hydrogen at the North Pole of Mercury, and the amount of hydrogen is consistent with all of the polar deposits consisting of water ice, but on average being buried by a few tens of centimeters of some other material that's less abundant in hydrogen than the water ice. So that was the first part of the story. The results from the neutron spectrometer validating that there's as much hydrogen at the poles as there should be if the polar deposits are mostly made out of water.
And then your laser altimeter indicated some light and dark regions near the poles of Mercury. How did those fit together with these neutron measurements indicating the presence of water ice?
The laser altimeter gave us 2 kinds of measurements that worked together beautifully. The laser altimeter is, of course, measuring the topography of the surface from the time it takes a pulse of laser energy to travel down to the planet and return to the spacecraft. Those topographic models allowed some of our team members to make new, very detailed thermal models of what the temperature should be at the surface of Mercury and just below the surface, a few tens of centimeters down. Using the topography and Mercury's orientation in space and the sunlight that the surface either does or does not receive to calculate the temperature field.
Mm-hmm.
And those thermal models made the prediction as to where we would see water ice stable directly at the surface and where we would see water ice stable, but only at a few tens of centimeters depth if it was buried by some other material that provided a thermal blanket, an insulation. Then the second step coming out of the laser altimeter was to measure the reflectance of the surface at the wavelength of the laser altimeter. Now, these radar deposits are in regions of permanent shadow. That's why the polar regions have areas sufficiently cold to trap water ice and preserve it for long periods of time. Because they're in permanent shadow, we can't use normal imaging methods to peer into those dark regions. But the laser altimeter is sending an active pulse on a different geometry than the sun. And so we can measure the reflectance of the surface even though the laser is peering into a region that's permanently shadowed. And what we found is that most of the polar deposits look dark. The thermal models also said that if you go far enough north, close enough to the North Pole, the temperatures get lower, and they get low enough for water ice to be stable as a solid for geologically long periods of time right at the surface. And we found that that prediction of the thermal models is borne out by the reflectance measurements. So we have the neutron spectrometer indicating that the material has the right abundance of hydrogen to be consistent with water ice. We have the thermal models now tied directly to the measurements of topography, and we have the reflectance indicating that indeed the water ice is present at the surface only in the coldest regions, and where it's somewhat warmer, there's some other material that's covering the ice to a depth of 10 or 20 centimeters that is very dark.
Now, let's have some numbers here. Mercury is the closest planet to the sun. I would expect some very high temperatures there. What's the difference between areas that may experience a lot of sunlight and those near the poles that might be permanently shadowed?
Mercury has a long solar day. The solar day lasts 6 months. Six of our months on Mercury. So if you lived and worked on the equator of Mercury, you would see a swing between daylight and nighttime of 600 degrees centigrade.
Wow.
1100 degrees Fahrenheit. Now, when you go to the poles of Mercury, because Mercury's spin axis tilts almost not at all from the perpendicular to its orbit, any topographic depression, like an impact crater, is in permanent shadow. And so regions that we see in permanent shadow from our spacecraft have been in permanent shadow for millions, hundreds of millions, probably billions of years. And in those permanently shadowed regions, it is very cold. It is 100 degrees Kelvin, 90 degrees Kelvin, minus 170, minus 180 degrees centigrade. So that once you get material like water ice into the so-called cold traps of these permanently shadowed regions, it will stay there indefinitely.
Wow. Now, going back, you mentioned that the darker areas near the poles here likely contained water ice below the surface, but that they were insulated by a thin layer of a different kind of material. What do these studies indicate that material is?
Well, at this point, what we know about the dark material is only that it is very low in reflectance, and we also know something about its temperature, because the temperature models tell us that the dark material is stable over a range of temperatures that extends to somewhat higher temperatures than the water ice itself. Those are still very important constraints. And if we look elsewhere in the solar system at what materials are out there that are common, that have the very low reflectance but are only stable at very low temperatures, the answer is organic rich material that is very common in the outer solar system. It's common in some comets and asteroids. So it's not a simple compound. It is a complex mix of organic material. Mm. And in Mercury's setting, it would probably undergo some very interesting chemistry driven by the very high radiation environment that Mercury's surface sees. So that may help to make it dark, but it is the temperatures that stabilize that material.
And so how did these materials, the water and the ice and then, you know, the carbon and the other organic materials here, how did those get to Mercury?
We can only guess, but it's an educated guess. And the guess is that both the water and the dark material, which we think is organic-rich material, were delivered by the same objects impacting Mercury. Some mixture of comets and the kinds of asteroids that are rich in organic and volatile material like water ice.
Mm-hmm.
These are very common objects in the solar system. We know many of them have orbits that bring them very close to the sun, and so it's inevitable that a number of them will have impacted. So we're looking at the cold traps of Mercury as collectors for cometary material that was thrown out during the impact of comets or organic rich asteroids onto Mercury's surface.
Ah, how interesting. And so you were actually on the Science podcast a little over a year ago. Stuart Wills interviewed you following some of the initial findings from MESSENGER's mission. And at that time, one of the open questions was where a lot of the volatiles that were present on Mercury had come from, because it appears as though Mercury has undergone some very high temperature processes, which presumably would have driven these volatiles off. So do these studies here help to answer that question?
They're part of the story. The surprise that we received on making the first chemical measurements of Mercury is that none of the theories for how Mercury was assembled are correct. So we're having to rewrite the books on how Mercury was assembled. and by implication, how all of the inner planets were assembled. And when they received their budget of volatile materials during the formation process, it's extremely relevant to the question of where Earth's water came from, when it was acquired, what other volatile constituents ended up in our own planet. So Mercury is an interesting witness plate to the history of delivery of volatile materials to the innermost reaches of the solar system. And the ice at the poles is only a recent chapter in that history, but it's one that might be very informative.
Great. Well, good things to come. Well, Sean Solomon, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Sean Solomon and colleagues discussed the presence of water and other volatiles on Mercury in a trio of Science Express reports this week. You can find the articles at www.scienceexpress.org.
Finally today, I'm here with science staff writer Meghna Sachdev, who's here to give us a rundown on some of the recent stories from our online daily news site. First up, we have a story about making a flu vaccine without a virus.
Yep, that's right. So researchers have managed to make a flu vaccine that doesn't actually use cultures of the virus. Mm-hmm. In fact, when they inject it into animals, the animals make the virus proteins themselves.
So how exactly is this approach different from our typical flu vaccines? What's going on here?
So typical flu vaccines are made by infecting either chicken eggs or cell cultures with the virus, and then two proteins are isolated and used as vaccines. This one is a little bit different because scientists made synthetic messenger RNA, or mRNA, which they then injected into mice and ferrets and pigs, and this messenger RNA gets the animals to actually produce the virus proteins themselves and confer immunity.
Okay, so now they're actually putting it in live animals.
Exactly.
And the animals start making parts of this virus themselves, and then their own immune system reacts to the parts of the virus that they produce. So this is a really cool and interesting new way of producing a vaccine, but why is this important? Why is this different or superior to our previous method?
Well, if it works, and we don't know if it will yet, the reason researchers are so excited is because one of the things it does is it speeds up the whole process. So with traditional vaccines, the virus has to be cultured in eggs or cell cultures, which takes a long time. It can take months. So for example, with our last pandemic, by the time they had enough virus to basically go around, we were well past the peak. So this sort of speeds up production time to about 6 to 8 weeks. The other thing that's quite exciting is that people who have allergies to eggs would be able to take these vaccines without worrying too much about going into anaphylactic shock, which is nice. And the researchers say it doesn't have to be refrigerated, so it should transport a little more easily.
So from a new technique to prevent us from getting sick, our next story looks at coughing in another animal.
I bet you didn't know that scallops were coughing, but when they do, what they're basically doing is they're trying to expel waste and water from their central cavity. So they have two valves, and the friction between them makes a sharp crack, and then there's a big drawn-out puffing sound, which is the valves closing very quickly. So that's their coughs.
Okay, so what do researchers hope to find out from studying these coughs?
Researchers hope that listening to scallop coughs and tracking scallop coughs will help them monitor water quality. So what they figured out is that scallops grow more slowly when there's toxic algae around. They hope that by monitoring the scallop coughs, they can figure out how the scallop's metabolisms are changing and keep an eye on water quality.
So how is this new? How have researchers attempted to study these coughs and other behaviors of mussels in the past?
One of the things they can do is to analyze these very, very fine scale patterns in scallop shells, which is pretty labor intensive. Another thing they can do is attach motion sensors to the scallops, which is, well, pretty disruptive, and presumably the scallops don't like it too much. I'm not sure. But this is exciting because these coughs are pretty sonically striking, and researchers can hear them from about 10 meters away. So it's not that labor intensive. It doesn't bother the scallops, and, you know, they can track it without putting in as much work.
Moving from one marine peculiarity to another, our third story focuses on a mysterious technique blue whales use for foraging.
Most people don't think of the blue whale as being too agile. Really, really big blue whales are heavier than trains, they're longer than two city buses, and they've got pretty small flippers and flukes. But apparently they're rolling around.
So can you describe this unique rolling behavior? What's exactly going on?
So basically, scientists were surprised to find that these whales were making full 360-degree rolls. So what they were doing was in about 4 to 5 seconds, they were rolling around 180 degrees and basically grabbing some lunch and then flipping back around to their typical belly up position.
So this is more like a pirouette than a flip, though, right?
They're not rolling end over end. They're rolling on their sides. That would be something.
So how did these researchers manage to capture video of this feeding technique?
Well, the first thing that happened was that these whales were basically being tracked by these suction cups that were full of sensors. And then researchers found that the whales were doing these weird rolls. And one of the whales had a little video camera attached to its back, which showed that they were doing these little rolls while they were having their lunch.
What do researchers think is the point of this? Why do researchers think blue whales are rolling onto their back before they catch food?
Well, they're not sure, but the thought is that the whales are flipping over, sneaking up on krill, which is their favorite food, from below, and then turning back around to better gulp it down.
Huh, wow. So, Meghna, what else have we had on the site this week?
Well, if you check out Science Now, we've got a story of a huge black hole in a pretty small galaxy, which is kind of weird. And check out our policy news site, Science Insider, to find out about ocean acidification, the CDC urging more young people to seek HIV testing, and the new head of the U.S. Science Committee, Lamar Smith. And also check out our Science Live chat next week, Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. It's about whether science will ever be able to defeat flu.
Great. Thanks, Meghna.
Thank you.
Meghna Sachdev is a staff writer for Science. You can check out all our news at news.sciencemag.org, including daily stories from Science Now and science policy from Science Insider. While you're there, be sure to check out Science Live, a live chat on the hottest science topics every Thursday at 3 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time.
And that concludes the November 30th, 2012 edition of the Science Podcast.
If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org.
The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Carrie Klein.
And I'm Edward Hermy. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.